Welcome to Candid Conversations About Home Health, a podcast jointly produced by NAHC, the National Association for Home Care and Hospice, and HHFMA, the Home Care and Hospice Financial Managers Association. This podcast series is moderated by Cindy Kraft and Karen Vance. Episode 3, Virtual versus In-Person Visits, How to Make an Informed Decision. Our guest today is Dr. Jason Falvey, Assistant Professor for the Department of Physical Therapy and Rehabilitation Science and the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health at the University of Maryland School of Medicine.
Hello again. This is Cindy Kraft and Karen Vance, and we are excited to be with you. And we have a special guest that you've been introduced to, but we want to give him time to share his wealth of information. But we got to set the stage a little bit. We know what the title says about virtual versus in-person visits. Before we go down that road, though, we want to talk a little bit about the current state of utilization. And Karen, you and I have had many a conversation, sometimes over a cocktail, about utilization, especially as we were gearing up for PDGM and the concerns about what may or may not happen to therapy use. And then we crossed over into 2020 and things got a little interesting, to say the least. What are you seeing right now with respect to utilization issues overall, potentially, and then looking at some of the things specific to rehab?
Well, I think it was interesting. I'm going to start with the specific to rehab simply because chronologically at the beginning of the year, I think you and I both were hearing from a lot of our own colleagues about the changes in with the payment model change to PDGM and getting some real, the industry getting some real pushback with the intent of trying to manage utilization a little bit more from the last 20 years of, as we used to say, therapists being ATM machines. So I think the beginning of the year, what we heard was resistance because it was being forced upon therapists. Then along comes the pandemic, and I think it was interesting that the discussion about virtual versus in-person visits took a different turn in terms of the need for it and the rationale behind it. And I think as now when we are having conversations with agencies across the country, people are indeed starting to get pretty creative, and especially since some of the flexibilities occurred and the waivers for allowing some of those telehealth, though extremely undefined, but nonetheless allowable on the plan of care. And so where I'm hoping we end up, Cindy, as you and I have talked on many occasions, is that it would be lovely if we could get people to think in terms of aligning those virtual visits or those in-between kind of touch points in between actual in-person visits to capitalize on them, capitalize on the participation from the part of the patient because it's the right thing to do, not because it's somebody else telling us it's what we have to do. That's what I think.
Leads us into why we asked you, Jason, to join us today. Because before, what I'd like to talk a little bit about first is some of the research you've been doing and are very familiar with, much more so than I am, about utilization in home health and kind of how that the correlations between access and rehospitalization risk. That's really a big, putting the pandemic aside for just a second, the concern in home health has always been about risk of them returning to higher cost care.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important risk to consider. But many of the traditional models and paradigms for preventing readmissions were really focused on nursing or pharmacy kind of outcomes. You know, they're focused on chronic condition management and focusing on medication reconciliation, whereas disability, which is a very robust risk factor for readmission, was not well addressed. And I think that was a major gap that we noticed a few years ago. And subsequent research has suggested that intensity of rehabilitation, perhaps even more so than nursing, is related to reductions in readmission risk for medically vulnerable older adults across a wide range of diagnoses. So I think it speaks to the importance of addressing disability in a multidisciplinary plan of care and making that an aggressive part of the plan of care, not just for a patient-centered outcome, but also linking it to these costly readmissions.
What other factors do you think come into play here with respect to access to home health services?
So our research has suggested that geographic location, so rural patients consistently across our orthopedic diagnoses and sepsis, both were receiving a small but significantly fewer physical therapy and occupational therapy visits. One in three patients actually never receive physical therapy after a diagnosis of sepsis, and that's more common in rural environments. Other factors, which may not surprise you, is medical complexity. So older adults that have the highest levels of comorbidity, the highest tertile, the most medically complex, and the patients that have the most underlying conditions receive fewer visits, and that may be because we don't have good models of care to manage people with multimorbidity, or it may be that therapists are concerned about exacerbating underlying conditions, or patients are canceling more and we're not, really emphasizing the importance of rehabilitation to those patients in a way that gets them motivated to participate.
Also, I know you've done some research and looking at folks that are coming out of intensive care units. And the visual for me, and I've shared this several times, is that, as folks are surviving the acute phase of COVID, and you see folks as they are leaving the hospitals, you've never seen any of those footage, despite all the positivity and the cheering and the everything else. Nobody is walking out the door. They are receiving a significant amount of help to get to their vehicle to return home. So kind of, the idea that many of these folks do end up in that level of care in an intensive care unit, how are those folks, even before the pandemic, accessing services?
Yeah, I mean, they often were going to home care. It may not surprise you that 60% of critical illness survivors are discharged home after hospitalization. If they're older adults, only about a quarter of those get home care. So it's relatively underutilized. And even when they go to home care, our research suggested that one in three never touch physical or occupational or speech therapy, despite high prevalence of disability, high prevalence of swallowing disorders, high prevalence of ADL dysfunction in this population. And there's really no formal models of care, despite research that's recently come out with COVID that suggests that these patients are successful. If they get rehabilitation therapy and they participate in home health care, they will experience good functional improvements. They don't get readmitted at rates that are higher than other home care populations, and they don't have any adverse safety responses that would suggest that it's not an appropriate setting for them.
I think I am curious to know, in your experience and what you've seen with some of the development of new approaches to healthcare, and particularly to home care, what kinds of characteristics do you see and clinicians that are going to be more what I'm going to use as term early adopters to different kinds of approaches, whether it's technology or not?
Yeah, I think this early adopter language is really important from an implementation standpoint. It's a research term as well. It's a good way to bridge. But typically, the early adopters are working for home health agencies who are not afraid to be innovative, that are not afraid to do things that perhaps aren't immediately reimbursable, and perhaps explore some of these alternative models of care. And you probably have noticed that the home health agencies that have been relatively successful scaling up with COVID have probably had tele-rehab infrastructure in place and have used it despite low reimbursement or no reimbursement, because they've invested in that to help overall improve outcomes without a direct reimbursement. So exploring different models of care, like providing therapy virtually as a bridge or in addition to on-site visits when those may not get reimbursed, that may be a successful way to help meet all of these rehabilitation needs for medically complex patients, more successfully bridge them to the next level of care, making sure they get to outpatient levels or visit their PCP, and really set clinicians up to be free to use their clinical experience to guide them in best practices versus using payment policy only to drive clinical decisions.
So Jason, what I'm hearing is the utilization of a comprehensive multidisciplinary approach in home health to those complicated patients, to those post higher intensity inpatient services was not really ideal before the pandemic. Then we saw an environment fueled partially by reimbursement models of old, where therapy was encouraged to go more often with some patients. So we're balancing between didn't really have access to some patients and then go ahead and see these others a whole bunch. That when we went into PDGM, started to ratchet some of that down. In the early days of the pandemic, we were hearing a lot of this term non-essential or essential services. And rehab kind of landed over leaning toward the non-essential. What are your thoughts? I mean, on the context of patient care, is there a concern about getting that kind of label of being non-essential in those circumstances?
Absolutely. Being labeled non-essential, whether or not that's by ourselves, by facilities, by the patients themselves and their families, it really puts a chilling effect on access. When physical therapists themselves are designating themselves as non-essential and taking themselves out of the running of providing care for these patients, it's a reputational harm for physical therapy as somebody who can provide high-level, full scope of practice care to medically complicated home health patients. When we think about access to facilities, many home health patients live in assisted living or senior living communities which have designated therapists without really any evidence to why as non-essential, and we're leaving patients with unmet rehabilitation needs, potentially elevating risks for falls or other traumatic hospitalizations that, you know, at this point, we cannot afford to be taxing our nation's healthcare system. Hospital beds are in short supply, and a fall or head trauma is certainly going to require intensive resources at a hospital level that may be far less safe for an older adult to access during a pandemic, and really taxing to a system which is really trying to care for a wide variety of patients that are being hospitalized with COVID-19. And so being designated non-essential is both public health dangerous and also dangerous for patients.
So we find ourselves in a situation, and although, you know, there's been kind of a therapy slant to the conversation thus far, when you touch on the ability to access individuals in those assisted living or older adult communities, nursing has felt the same issue of being, you know, limited in terms of the access or only allowed in certain numbers of times or those kinds of things. So we find ourselves with patients that have higher acuity needs, need a variety of services, whether or not they had COVID in the past tense or simply, you know, being managed for the more routine conditions we would see, we have access impeded for a variety of reasons. So that kind of tees us up for, okay, so how do we best manage? Because we have a lot of things going on at the same time. And when we start talking about virtual visit, I think historically it's been the vision of, you know, calling the patient up on the phone and talking with them. And again, that has seemed to be, well, nursing can do that. I mean, nurses have been doing that for a period of time in the management of using the original type telehealth machines where they would look at the vital signs and call the patient and have that interaction. But you start talking about a virtual therapy visit and our peers, PT, OT, and speech all kind of look like, yeah, no. I mean, we are a very hands-on group of people, and the idea of a virtual therapy visit feels like less than, not good care. What are your thoughts, before we kind of dig into the decisioning, what are your thoughts to say to a therapist who's really like, you know, I understand those needs are there, Jason, and I'm doing the best that I can to get in, but I have people that don't let me in, and I got to be physically there to provide therapy?
Yeah. I tell these therapists that they're selling themselves short if they don't think their skill set translates to virtual visits. And if you feel like every bit of your scope of practice is hands-on, you're missing the important communication, you're missing the important educational interventions that we provide that are probably more impactful in the long run to patients. And I think there's many, many patients who can benefit from, guided exercise or physical activity coaching, which can be done in person or virtually across many populations, according to the research, with minimal impact on outcomes. So while there are some populations who virtual visits aren't appropriate for, I think we definitely have to broaden our thinking about what we can provide virtually. And I think there's a wide variety of what physical therapy can do with or without caregivers present to provide services remotely, both during a pandemic and also afterwards.
And you and I had the opportunity to collaborate on trying to come up with some sort of decisioning guide on a virtual versus an in-person visit. And we worked together through the home health section of the American Physical Therapy Association. And we kind of boiled it down to some key considerations. So I'm going to kind of lob them back to you, Jason, so you can elaborate kind of on what those particular areas, what those considerations should be. I think a strong theme we unearthed was cognitive issues, where the patient's cognitive issue should be taken into consideration of virtual versus in-person.
Absolutely. And cognitive issues are probably one of the biggest reasons for telemedicine unreadiness. But cognitive issues alone in a patient with good social support might not preclude virtual visits. But if a patient has cognitive impairment to the point where they can't meaningfully participate via phone or video conference or work the technology or you really need to be on site to check safety, many of those patients are going to benefit from at least an on-site evaluation to assess home safety. So unless that patient with cognitive impairment has strong caregiver support, then these things really should be conducted on site, these evaluations and treatment visits as appropriate.
And I kind of teed you up that way on purpose, Jason, because I think people are looking for a very, black or white. If they have cognitive issues, as an example, then all visits have to be in person. But much like most things patient care related, it's an interrelationship of things. It's looking at their cognitive status in the context of their support system. And taking that beyond just the cognitive issue specifically, wouldn't you say that their support system comes into play as another strong factor of whether or not they can be safely managed by the incorporation of virtual visits?
Yeah, absolutely. If people have inadequate social support and unmet needs in their home for activities of daily living, they're already at high risk for hospital readmissions and emergency department visits and falls. And if we don't get into that home, if they're inadequately socially supported, we don't get into that home to start bridging those needs. That doesn't mean we need to be in there 5 days a week, but it certainly might mean with people with inadequate social support that those are people that in-person visits will pay dividends and probably reduce their overall risk. But if you have very strong social support from adequate caregivers or assisted living staff who are committed to providing restorative interventions, you could easily provide those things via coaching. You can provide guidance on completing a home exercise program. You take your uncomplicated total joint replacement patient, may be able to go through knee range of motion exercises relatively safely with a caregiver present, where your demented patient with congestive heart failure and significant fall risk without social support may really require you to be in the home.
I think a term that comes into play here is the issue of dosing. For me, that term gives us a different slant to what we're really talking about today, which is how am I dosing my interactions with these patients? And I see a lot in my day job of, it looks like we just put the same frequency and duration. They're all in person. They're all either twice a week or three times a week for X number of weeks and see very little variability based on the individual needs of the patient. So I think by looking at the cognitive issue, the support issue, and then really evaluating, and this is a tough thing, I'm not saying this is easy, but to look at the activities that need to be done for this individual, what really does require the hands-on physical presence of a trained clinician versus what could be coached. I like that you use that word because I think we don't value our ability to coach very well. I think we do it when we're used to being out in the home and there's a caregiver and we instruct them and they have them demonstrate and we leave instructions. I don't think we really think about that as coaching, but could we do similar things for some of our patients remotely and that our physical presence providing that education isn't really the magic part, as it were, as much as it is the ability to impart knowledge to others to be able to successfully follow through.
And Cindy, I'd like to add one thing to that. And as you were finishing up that statement, you landed on what I was thinking during this whole last part of the conversation, and that is, what is the intent? What is the end result we're supposed to be trying to get from this coaching? And it's not just counting repetition from a home exercise program, but the coaching part of it to both the patient and the caregiver for the end result for them to have ownership over their own health. And I don't think that we as caregivers do a very good job of that.
Oh, again, the OT is showing. Jason, she's always got to take it back to self-management because, you know, we're trying to get these folks to be able to manage these conditions without our physical presence. I mean, that's ultimately what we're trying to do is not to create long-term codependence through our care, but to say, how do you successfully manage through what we're able to impart during our time together? So I think things like considering a virtual visit, I would never say, you know, oh, it's been so many good things have happened because of the pandemic. It's been awful. But it's also kind of made us have these opportunities to really look at why we do what we do. And maybe, you know, a year ago, virtual therapy visit, why, you know, I just kind of do what I do. But this is not, you know, going to be going on for just another month or another 2 months. And even past the acute phase of the pandemic, we may find that we are able to extend our reach as individual disciplines through the use of virtual visits, through the use of telehealth and apps and different things in ways we didn't consider until we kind of had to. So I like what you said earlier, Jason, that Karen, you kind of teed him up with the issue of early adopters and taking those chances and trying it. I think we have a period of time here to try some of these things, and we wouldn't do it willy-nilly, which is why we always look at each individual patient situation. But I think it's an opportunity to test it out, see how this works, and really be looking at how will this shape care going forward, not just from pandemic crisis mode and then some magic day we're all going to go back to how we used to do it. Jason, do you think that's realistic?
Yes, I do. I think, you know, it takes strong leadership in these agencies to really make these things happen and, you know, some appetite for risk. But I think there are a lot of ways that our system is well set up to do this. And I think we have very innovative and dynamic people in this field to lead the charge and being innovative and doing these things both, you know, internally, but also taking steps to disseminate what works on a national scale, share it with others, and really start to innovate as a you know, as a whole home health agency network and not just as individual agencies.
Well, and it also is kind of good to tie it back to the fact that, you know, if we can not poke the bear and start a whole loop of conversation, our payment methodology is built on the characteristics and needs of the patient. We're not paid by the visit. So this is another opportunity to stretch ourselves a little bit and really look at how do we effectively manage our patients appropriately in this particular setting. So Jason, I want to thank you for joining us today. Karen, as always, great to spend time with you. And I want to thank all of our listeners for their participation in today's discussion.
Thank you for listening to Candid Conversations About Home Care, a podcast jointly produced by NAC and HHFMA. For more information, visit our website at www.nahc.org.